The horizon had been a dreary, saffron-tinted waste for as long as he could remember. Suddenly, a dark speck crawled across the vast sea of sand. All around was a panorama of desolation. Nothing but sand stretching to the skyline in every direction, barely relieved by the gray dome rearing out of the wasteland in the near distance. The god blinked. The crawling speck was a vehicle, that much was certain. He expanded his awareness, his mind sprouting probing, identifying tentacles. The vehicle was a Jeep Cherokee. It was more than 100 years old, the engine reconfigured to run on methane, and the rusted bodywork was painted in a striped camouflage pattern. Its four-wheel drive carried it easily across the undulating yellow sands that rose and fell in dunes. There were precisely 3 men and 1 woman aboard. The distant sound of the engine rolled over the desert, and the vehicle sank from sight behind the waves of sand. At that moment, a cloud passed over the face of the sun. The god smiled. Slowly, he climbed down from the high sand hill upon which he had been meditating for the past 3 days. Holding his mata'u across his left breast, the god strolled across the sandy, windswept plain in the direction of his tomb. He had waited for 6 months for his worshippers to arrive, and there was no hurry now, even though they would reach his tomb a few minutes before he would. They, however, wouldn't be able to open the portal. By the time he reached the perimeter of his tomb, the vehicle was parked in front of the reinforced stone and steel dome. The 4 people were totally engrossed in trying to figure out the workings of the massive vanadium alloy sector. The god paused and looked at them. In less than a millisecond, he assimilated all that he needed from their minds. He was pleased that English was still the primary language, though now peppered with new colloquialisms, vernacular, and vulgarisms. The 4 people were part of a larger group, a loosely knit conglomeration of wanderers, scavengers, and self-styled salvage experts calling themselves Farers. They had come from a settlement of sorts only a day's journey away, crossing the wasteland they called the Barrens. The god wasn't surprised by the vast changes from the world he had been born into. Even before his long sleep, the American continent was already molding itself into Deathlands. He narrowed the focus of his probe to the individuals. There was Danielson, the leader of this little band of survivors. He was black-bearded, trim and erect, though wiry of stature. The woman beside him was Harrier, a woman who appeared brisk and no-nonsense in a neat white tunic, khaki shorts, and high-laced boots. The other 2 men were Stockbridge and Javna, and they were identically attired in patched and stained coveralls. Javna was the oldest of the 4, with thinning white hair and no teeth. Stockbridge was around Danielson's age, a muscular black man of medium height. All 4 people shared similar thoughts, similar goals. They needed to survive Deathlands, and in order to do that, they had to travel, salvaging what they could from stockpiles laid down by the pre-Newcost government. In Danielson's mind was the vivid image of a man he considered both an inspiration and a competitor in his profession. The man went by the name of the Traitor, and the god glimpsed pieces of memory of vehicles called war wags. Danielson envied the Traitor, but he also admired him, even though he had been cast out of the Traitor's organization a short time before. Looking into the minds of Javna and Stockbridge was like peering into the minds of small venal rodents. Greed, anger, and the resentful suspicion that they had been cheated by Danielson, Harrier, and even the whole world dominated their thoughts and emotions. The god focused on Harrier, and he realized that he was looking at her form rather than her mind. Harrier was a slim woman in her early 20s. She had no idea just how old she really was. Her hair was dark, and it framed her face in a silken bell. Her first name was Connie. The god realized that Connie was a diminutive of the ancient Celtic name Connaught. The god allowed himself a certain small pride in staging a dramatic entrance. He drew breeze-driven grains of sand to him and directed them to swirl about him until he had the appearance of a miniature cyclone, a man-sized dust devil. The god moved toward the portal of his tomb, and he appreciated the expressions of dismay and surprise that crossed the faces of the people when they spied the whirling cloud of grit. When he reached an appropriate distance from the 4 mortals, he allowed the wind to dissipate and the sand to fall away from his body. Danielson's mouth gaped open in shock. His leathery right hand fumbled at his hip and came up with an automatic pistol, one the god identified from the man's mind as a 9mm Steel City War Eagle. manufactured 120 years before. The god knew that the gun, the blaster as Danielson thought of it, contained only three projectiles. Though all four people were armed, only Javna's Taurus P-299 carried a full 15-shot clip. As it was, although all four people drew their blasters, they were totally unnerved by his sudden materialization. For an instant, he saw himself through their eyes. They saw a giant bronze-skinned man whose life hadn't been spent in savage conflict with the new nature of Deathlands, but a man whose form bespoke the intention to bend that nature to his will. That intention showed in his strong, moody face, the hard-muscled economy of his form, his heavy arms, broad shoulders, and massive chest. He wore a linen loincloth, gold necklace, and a royal King Cobra headdress that, the gods saw from their minds, none of them recognized. Nor did they recognize the silver, 3-foot-long forked rod he held over his muscular chest as a weapon. Or perhaps they were too distracted by the shimmering crimson of his eyes.
Good day. Would you care to step inside out of the sun?
We might. You staked a claim on this here stockpile?
It's not a stockpile, Mr. Danielson. It's my tomb. I require worshippers to help me build the dynasty. You four will do for a start.
How'd you know my name? You're some kind of Psy Mutie.
Yeah, gotta be with them eyes.
Your invitation to accompany me inside is rescinded, Mr. Javna.
Javna brought up his weapon, finger crooked tight around the trigger.
I'm inviting you to die, you mutie whore, son.
The god moved the Mata'u negligently, pointing the double prongs, positioned like an upside-down V at the tip of the rod, toward the old man's bio-negative weak points. Pale blue Mana energy sprang up in a halo around Javna. Javna's frail body swayed, and the sway became a tremble, and the tremble turned into a convulsion. His eyes remained open, but they didn't see. His toothless mouth gaped open, but no words came out. The old man's back arched violently, as if he had received a heavy blow between the shoulders. Spittle strings drooled from discolored gums. In the corner of each bulging eye squeezed a droplet of blood. Then, Javna's eyes burst in jealous, crimson-tinged sprays. For an instant, all saw the raw, dark pits of empty sockets. Javna coughed out a torrent of blood, fountaining up from hemorrhaging internal organs. He toppled sideways, falling to the sand, arms contorting and drawing up like the gnarled branches of a leafless tree. He seemed to shrivel and wither like a mummy, even as he fell. Harrier, after a moment of wide-eyed shock, swung her handgun toward the god, her finger tightening around the trigger.
Stop.
Harrier stopped, her finger frozen on the trigger. Danielson and Stockbridge stood immobile. The god lowered the Mata'u and stepped toward Harrier. Her eyes stared into his defiantly, even though her limbs were paralyzed. The god looked deep, deep into her mind. What he found there pleased him. She stood there and allowed her memories, her dreams, her unrealized ambitions and most secret fantasies and passions to be rifled.
Carnot Catherine Harrier, Connie, I need you. I intend to impose order on the remains of this world by building a dynasty that will rule for 10,000 years.
What do you need me for?
First, to take me to your settlement, where I will collect my followers. Then we will proceed to my royal city. It lies some distance away. And then you will bear me an heir.
I'm sterile.
A congenital condition which I can rectify.
What?
Drop your weapon, Connie. It's useless against me, you know.
Suddenly, she was able to move again, and she stared in mild surprise as her weapon dropped from her hand to the sand at her feet. The god mentally nudged her toward the vanadium alloy door. He sensed the reactions of the three people. Their emotions were a riot of conflicting questions, terrors, and fears. Harrier stopped walking, and the god was impressed with the degree of concentration she employed to break free, momentarily, of his persuasion.
What the fuck are you?
I have many names. Alpha was the first. A woman I once knew called me Alfie as an endearment. Hell Eyes was more of a title than a name, and I never cared for it. Since my resurrection, I have decided to be addressed as Akhenaten. Old name with a fine tradition.
I don't care about your name. What are you?
I am who you have been waiting for, Connie. I am your god.
Sixteen years later, Ryan opened his eye, and Christy was still there. The moon formed a halo around her full mane of scarlet hair, striking flame-colored highlights from the flowing tresses. With an effort, he managed to hitch himself up to his elbows. He looked around, his brain still unsteady from his near drowning and the beating he had received from the self-styled Admiral Poseidon. Little flares of pain ignited all over his body. He lay on the gently rocking deck of the small cabin cruiser. Flinging aside the blanket, he saw that his naked body was covered with abrasions and contusions. The salt air of the sea stung his wounds, and they pulled when he moved. Christy handed him a cup of fresh water, and he drank gratefully, rinsing his mouth and spitting over the side.
How long, lover?
A couple of hours. How do you feel?
Waterlogged. Where's everybody else?
Down below, trying to get some rest. It was too cramped for me. What happened to Poseidon?
He sleeps with the fishes.
With Christy's help, Ryan managed to get to his feet. Standing at his full 6 feet 2 inches, he drew the tall, voluptuous woman against him, stroking her hair, noting that her normally brilliant green eyes were dulled by exhaustion.
What about you? Are you all right?
I called on the power of Gaia. Men died.
Ryan didn't ask for details. Christy Roth was by definition a mutie. She possessed the empathic ability to sense danger in the offing. Her fiery mane of red hair was the outward manifestation of this power, stirring, curling, moving as if it were a separate sentient organism. The few others with these prescient powers were called doomseers or doom sniffers. Christy had been trained to hone this empathy by being in tune with the electromagnetic energies of Gaia, the Earth Mother. By tapping into these energies, the power field of the planet itself, Christy could gain superhuman strength for a limited time. When possessed by Gaia, she entered an altered state of consciousness and turned into a raging death goddess. However, her manipulation of Earth energies could only be used on occasion, as it exacted a great physical toll. Therefore, she had learned to handle her .38 caliber Smith & Wesson Model 640 revolver with devastating skill. Ryan saw that her sidearm wasn't holstered at her hip.
What happened to your blaster?
I don't know. Poseidon's Sekmen must have confiscated it when they captured me and Jack.
Where are my clothes?
They should be dry by now. I'll tell everybody you're up.
Draping the blanket over his shoulders, Ryan sat on the side rail, scanning the roiling starlit surface of the Atlantic Ocean. Somewhere below swam the Dwellers, humans genetically altered to live in the depths of the sea. One of the muties, a fisherman named Mike, had rescued him from drowning when he had escaped from Poseidon's sinking submarine, the Raleigh. Poseidon's plan to destroy Shauna Watson's commune with the refitted Raleigh had been scuttled. Though Ryan Carter had no great love for muties, he wished the Dwellers well. Lifting his gaze, he looked in the direction of the King's Point naval base. Tongues of flame still licked at the night sky. He could only hope that the building containing the Mat-Trans unit hadn't been consumed in the conflagration. Christy came out of the cabin, holding his clothes and combat boots. She was followed by the other members of his group, and they clustered around him, patting his back and pumping his hand until they realized he was wincing under the affection. Mildred Wyeth shooed everyone back.
Ryan's injuries haven't gotten in much healing time in the past 2 hours.
Mildred Winona Wyeth was a doctor, a former specialist in cryogenic sciences. Though she was in her mid-30s, she was chronologically well over a century old. Mildred had entered a hospital in late December of 2000 for minor surgery, but an allergic reaction to the anesthetic had necessitated her body being placed in cryonic stasis until a treatment could be found. It never was. The world was blown apart before she was revived, and she slept like a fly trapped in amber for 100 years. Ryan had found her in a shielded underground cell, her life support system still functioning. He had brought her back to life, the cryo process miraculously healing her into a world she could never have dreamed existed. Other than her skills as a doctor, Mildred had also proved herself invaluable as a tenacious survivalist. She had won a silver medal for free pistol shooting in the last ever Olympic Games. A checkmate ZKR 551 target revolver was holstered at her waist. The weapon was chambered to take Smith & Wesson 38 caliber rounds, and she had only rarely been known to miss with one of its six shots.
Good. No broken veins? I was afraid you might be suffering a touch of anoxemia.
What's that?
A lack of oxygen in the blood. You damn near drowned, you know. Good thing I had Dean here to help me with the first aid. At least he learned something in that school.
Now 11 years old, Dean was almost a miniature version of his father, with thick dark hair and bright blue eyes. The fierce warrior named Ryan Cotter grew used to being called Dad and was totally devoted to the boy. A few months before, he had enrolled Dean in the Brody School in Colorado. He had only recently been reunited with him. While his son had received an education, Ryan had been more determined than ever to find a place in Deathlands where the boy could be raised in relative safety. He had never truly believed he would find that safe place, but now a twinge of regret came to him, along with the memories of the beautiful valley of Tarawa and his banishment from it. And yet he knew that they were not of that place and didn't belong there.
What happened to the sub?
It sank.
Down went McGinty to the bottom of the sea, dressed in his best suit of clothes.
What?
An old sea shanty, the authorship of which is attributed, I believe, to one Popeye the Sailor Man.
Ryan wasn't sure if the tall, thin, silver-haired man was joking. Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner was another refugee from a past time period. Unlike Mildred, who had bobbed unknowingly down the temporal stream, Doc was the only surviving subject of a cold-hearted scientific practice known in pre-dark days as time trawling. There were several subdivisions of the experiment, such as over Project Whisper, Project Cerberus, and Operation Kronos. With the use of a complex matter transfer device, or gateway, the project scientists had tried time and time again to snatch subjects from a past temporal line and trawl them to the present. Their only success was a man trawled from 1896, Theophilus Algernon Tanner, Ph.D., scientist and scholar, was plucked from the bosom of his beloved family and deposited in a sterile subterranean chamber a century hence. Though he learned all he could about the 20th century, Doc never forsook the hope of returning to his wife and two children. His constant attempts to return to his own era so angered the Whitecoats that they eventually used him as a trawling subject again. Rather than send him back, they opted to transfer him to a year nearly a century in the future. Like Mildred, he missed the new cost by less than a month. The experiences of being trawled had unbalanced his brain to a degree. Though most of the time Doc's wit was sharp and intelligence burned behind his blue eyes like a white-hot bar, his mind would occasionally drift back and forth across the centuries, usually to his home and family, lost in the shadows of time. However, even with his mind befogged, he was still a deadly shot with his gold-plated commemorative Jeb Stuart nine-shot Lamar, and the ebony lion's head sword stick he had tucked under an arm concealed a razor-keen blade of the finest Toledo steel. Everyone else in the group were the products of late 21st century America and of the hellgrounds known as Deathlands. The young man next to Doc, 16-year-old Jack Lauren, had all the hard, bitter experience of a man twice his age. An albino with fearsome ruby eyes and a shock of bone-white hair, he favored bladed weapons over guns, though he normally carried a .357 Magnum Colt Python. Jack had buried two sets of families during his young life, his folks back in Louisiana, and his wife and infant daughter in New Mexico. He hid the tragedies behind a taciturn mask and an eerily calm, almost detached manner. Ryan Cotter and John Barrymore Dix had been companions for nearly two decades, since they traveled with a legendary trader in a pair of huge war wags. The weapons dealer had been their undisputed leader and mentor, even something of a father figure to Ryan. JB had served as the trader's armorer and gunsmith because of his knowledge and skill with weaponry. A broad-brimmed bullet-hole fedora sat at a jaunty angle on his head, and wire-rimmed spectacles were perched on the bridge of his bony nose. His multi-pocketed, voluminous coat almost swallowed his short, slight frame. But it also concealed a 9mm mini Uzi machine pistol and a Smith & Wesson M4000 shotgun, which fired eight rounds of razor-edged, needle-pointed flechettes. His quiet, taciturn manner was in direct counterpoint to his ability to kill.
Our best chance to get out of here is to reach the gateway into the main building.
The manner in which Ryan and his companions frequently traveled was to use the gateway chambers to make Matt Trans jumps. The gateways were hidden in subterranean military complexes called redoubts, which were positioned all over the continent, even in other countries. One of the Matran's units lay in a subterranean complex beneath the King's Point base. Poseidon had been unable to access it, since the entrance codes to the security door had been consumed in the nuclear megacoal of a century before.
Is it functional?
There's no reason why it shouldn't be. I do know I don't want to spend any more time floating around out here.
I concur. Though I have a bit of sailing experience, none of us is born to the sea, so to speak.
There may be some of Poseidon's sec men prowling around, and we're underarmed.
Poseidon chilled. Second-in-command Brosnan chilled. Nobody alive to get a sec man orders or to give him pay. They won't want to fuck with us for free.
Maybe so. It's worth the risk. Let's move while we've still got the night.
Doc returned to the cabin and keyed the cruiser's engine to life, while Dean and Jack hoisted the anchor. Doc steered the craft in the direction of King's Point. JB joined Ryan in the bow, handing him the Smith & Wesson scattergun while he unlimbered the mini Uzi. Both of them scanned the dark water ahead. The boat cut through the sea slowly but steadily. As they drew closer to the arrangement of concrete quays and jetties extending over the water, Ryan was able to discern more details of the devastation JB and Mildred had visited on the installation. Smoke boiled from many of the low-roofed buildings in the compound, and the fires cast a hellish illumination over the entire base.
You didn't take half measures.
Do I ever?
Under Doc's guidance, the craft approached a concrete jetty. Suddenly, an 18-foot launch swung around the headland. It was painted a drab military gray. The sound of its diesel engines had been swallowed up by the sound of their own craft. The boat was about 100 yards away now, and three men stood behind the steel-framed windshield. The man handling the wheel was dark-complexioned, and his companions were crew-cut, beefy men in one-piece coveralls, the duty uniform of Poseidon's mercenaries. Ryan spotted an M60 tripod-mounted machine gun bolted to the deck behind them.
Fire blast.
The boat lunged toward them, its prow like the snout of a gray killer whale arrowing in on helpless prey. One of the crew-cut mercs scrambled aft, hands clawing for the machine gun, swinging around its long, perforated barrel.
Doc, evasive! Feed her more gas!
The craft churned forward. Synchronized with the sudden increase in speed, the tripod-mounted M60 spat flickering spear points of flame. Miniature waterspout sprayed up just behind the cruiser's stern. The range was too great for the scattergun which Ryan had to be very effective, so JB opened fire with his Uzi. Sparks jumped from the metal braced hull of the launch, and the windshield acquired a starred pattern of cracks. The pilot twisted the wheel, and the boat heeled over. The streamlined craft made a lunging portside rush, while the gunner kept up a withering machine gun fire. Ryan and JB dropped flat to the deck. Glass smashed in the pilot housing. Sheet metal crumpled, and fiberglass was shot away.
Dean! Christy! Jack! Everybody all right?
Yeah, we're okay, damn it.
What about you, Doc? Are you still with us?
Indeed!
Stay low!
The cruiser's speed increased again, cutting a liquid trough through the dark water. Ryan and JB raised their heads above the rail. The launch was roaring toward them again, this time approaching fast from starboard aft.
I'm getting sick of this.
Not much we can do about it. They're faster, more maneuverable, and they outgun us.
Yeah.
JB dipped his hand inside one of his capacious pockets, and came up gripping a small, apple-sized metal sphere. Ryan recognized it immediately as a V-40 mini-gren, the smallest hand grenade manufactured before the new cost.
One of the little goodies I picked up in the commune's armory.
The thing is so small you'll have to make a direct hit to do any damage.
That's the idea.
The launch roared up, parallel with the cruiser's port side, the engines roaring as though by the display of sheer speed and power, the people on board the smaller craft would be cowed into surrendering. Only a dozen or so feet separated the two boats. JB rolled himself to port, then rose to his knees. He unpinned the Gren with his left hand, and his right arm swung up and out in a looping overhand throw.
Yeah.
Ryan lifted himself from the deck so he could watch the arc and descent of the small object. He figured it would splash into the water just in front of the launch's bow. Instead, with unerring and uncanny accuracy, JB bounced the Gren off the curving windshield to drop on the boat's deck. A blast of orange flame erupted. Pieces of wood and chunks of metal rose into the air. The man behind the machine gun catapulted over the side, wreathed in a cocoon of fire. The cruiser pulled away from the launch, leaving it to wallow in the surf. tongues of flame emit a dazzling glow over the face of the sea.
And that is that.
Close, lover.
Another trick out of those Captain Kangaroo pockets of yours, JB. One day, I'll have to take an inventory.
Who's Captain Kangaroo? Another sailor like that Popeye guy Doc mentioned?
I believe my expert seamanship contributed a little something to our narrow escape.
Congratulations, Doc. You dived good. Now drive to dry land.
Doc held the cruiser's stern straight for the concrete jetty. Turning the wheel, he ran alongside it, so close that the hull scraped the pilings. Then he reversed the engines and backed water into a smother of foaming spray.
How's that for driving?
More like, how's that for showing off?
As the cruiser bobbed in the shallows, Ryan and JB climbed out and secured it with a hawser, snugging the craft fast. They stood watch as the rest of the companions disembarked. Ryan held the scattergun at waist level.
Usual red alert. Lock and load.
Doc drew his Lama, Jack his 357 Colt Python, Mildred her ZKR revolver, and Dean unholstered his Browning high power. He brought up the rear behind the weaponless Christie. Ryan took the point, since he was the most familiar with the layout. They moved alertly between the twisting columns of acrid smoke. All of them frequently wiped their stinging eyes. However, Ryan saw that the devastation wasn't quite as total as he had initially figured. Only a few of the buildings in the sprawling compound were completely consumed by fire, though almost all of them were soot-blackened with windows shattered by the explosive charges set by Mildred and JB. The vapor suddenly cleared, diminishing to a misty pall. Ryan saw the rambling, flat-roofed concrete block building that housed the Matrans unit beneath it. It appeared intact. On the far side of it lay the submarine pens, where the undersea craft of the pre-dark navy had once been berthed. Motioning the people behind him to stop, Ryan went to one knee, taking a slow visual wreck of the structure and the surrounding area. He considered circling the building, approaching it from a concrete slipway that ran from the rear down to the sea. However, he saw no signs of movement anywhere. He hoped that the Sekhmen on the launch were the last to have fled the base. Standing, he gestured for his companions to come forward.
Standard deployment. We're going in by the front door. Triple red.
The seven people fanned out in a half circle as they moved toward the front of the building. Mildred held her ZKR 551 in a two-fisted grip, the barrel as steady as stone. Next to her, JB crouched to make himself a smaller target, the Uzi braced at his hip, finger on the trigger. Doc stood sideways like an 18th-century dandy practicing the code duello, the Lama at the end of his extended arm. Dean and Jack held their guns in both hands, barrels pointing up. As Ryan expected, the chrome and glass-paneled door was unlocked. The building had been an administrative center before the nuke cost, and therefore didn't possess the security measures of high-clearance areas. The fluorescent tubes glowing on the ceiling showed him that the reception room and the corridor beyond were deserted. He moved in fast, shifting the barrel of the scattergun back and forth. The others came in behind him. Most of the doors lining either side of the long hallway were open. Glancing into the first four offices, Ryan saw that they were jumbled, ransacked. Evidently, Poseidon's Sekhmen had looted everything of value from the building before leaving. They followed the corridor along two turns, first to the left, then to the right, before it dead-ended at the set of double doors that Ryan wanted. They hung open, and the big room beyond was full of desks and chairs. A bank of monitor screens was still linked to the security vidnet, and they flickered with images. Ryan swept a glance over them, saw that they showed essentially the same smoke-clouded pics from different perspectives, and turned away.
Hey, Dad! Look at this!
Earning, Ryan saw his son standing before a tall row of six gray lockers, the hasps secured by round combination locks.
The locks aren't rusty. People here must have been using them.
Our blasters might be inside one of them. We'll have to shoot off the locks. Mildred?
Precision is my middle name. Everybody take cover.
As her friends hunkered down behind desks, Mildred dragged a table over the end of the locker row, arranging it so she would have a parallel angle of fire. Half lying across the tabletop, she brought the lock on the far end into target acquisition and squeezed the ZKR's trigger. Ryan rose and pulled the shattered metal away from the hasp. Hanging inside the locker was a dress uniform of one of the King's Point enlisted men.
Ah,
Frustrated, he slammed the door shut and returned to his position behind a desk. He and Mildred repeated the procedure with the next four lockers. Each one contained uniforms or personal bric-a-brac. She aligned the sixth and last lock with the sights of her weapon.
After burning this many rounds, I don't know if I'll feel better if our stuff is in there or not.
The lock jumped, flew apart, and Ryan checked the container's contents. He removed his Steyr rifle, his 18-inch Panga, his Sig Sauer, and Christie's Smith & Wesson.
It would have to be the last locker.
Depends on how you look at it. It could have been the first locker. You just started at the wrong end.
Ryan, this kid of yours is entering the smartass stage.
Ah, then he is in the proper company.
Time to go down.
Ryan led the way across the room to an alcove barred by a wood-paneled door. He stepped out onto the concrete landing of a stairway that pitched downward. Having descended the stairs a few hours earlier, Ryan again took the point. The walls were of blue-gray concrete, lit by flickering fluorescent fixtures. Arrows painted on the walls at each landing pointed down. Small air vents just beneath the low ceilings played a continuous flow of cool, recycled air. The stairwell led to a narrow corridor, which ended 100 feet away at a vanadium steel door recessed into the wall. It was hexagonal in shape and a bright green in color. On the floor, a few feet in front of it, lay the bullet-blasted corpse of one of Poseidon's mercs, a bespectacled man Ryan had dubbed Specs. Ryan stepped over the body and approached the portal cautiously, careful not to tread in the wide pool of drying blood spread around it. The torso of a man floated in the crimson lagoon, sightless eyes staring at the ceiling. His face was frozen in an open-mouthed rictus of agony. His body was bisected, cut neatly in half at the waist by the multi-ton door.
His name was Jonesy. He fell down in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And then he was beside himself.
I knew you'd say that.
Ryan punched in the entrance code on the keypad panel fixed to the doorframe. The sec door rose upward swiftly. As it did, it automatically tripped a photoelectric beam, and overhead lights flickered to a dim, yellowish life. Ryan entered, stepping over the lower portion of Jonesy's body. The first time he had entered a redoubt, his mind had reeled with impossible conjectures. He had been shocked, stunned, awed. Most of the technology he had seen held no meaning for him, because there had never been anything like it in any of the stockpiles he had uncovered with a trader. The high-ceilinged room beyond the sector wasn't a redoubt. It was cramped, barely 12 by 15. A master control console ran the length of the east wall. Liquid crystal displays and glass-covered readouts blinked and flashed purposefully. Everything still functioned. All the circuitry still drawing on the nearly eternal power provided by nuclear engines. Ryan checked the door to the chamber, pulling up on the handle. The MAT-TRANS unit, like most of the others they had seen, was a six-sided chamber. The floor consisted of an interlocking pattern of raised metal discs, and the same pattern was duplicated on the ceiling. Ryan understood, in theory, that the MAT-TRANS units required a dizzying number of maddeningly intricate electronic procedures, sequenced by an array of computers and microprocessors. Though he accepted at face value that the machines worked, he had never grown accustomed to the concept that minds that created such stupendously complicated devices couldn't have found a way to prevent the nuke cost. The gateway's destination and coordinate lock codes had long ago vanished. Though a control keypad was affixed to the chamber door, it responded only to the LD, last destination button. This key would, if pressed within 30 minutes of a successful jump, reactivate the gateway and return them to their original transmission point. Ryan eased the heavy door to the chamber all the way open, allowing the rest of his party to enter. Once inside, everyone knew what to do, sitting on the floor discs in their usual positions. No matter how many times they had done it, the seconds before a gateway jump were always anxious. They seldom knew where or into what situation they would materialize. As was his habit, JB took off his fedora and carefully stowed his glasses in an inner pocket of his coat. Mildred took his hand. Doc sat beside her, laying the ebony sword stick at his side. Jack sat cross-legged against the wall, with Dean next to him. After everyone was ready, Ryan pulled the door shut and triggered the jump mechanism. Jackson sat next to Christy, putting an arm around her. The discs in the floor and ceiling exuded a glow. The glow brightened, and a mist shot through with flashing sparks formed below the ceiling discs and rose from the floor, thickening to a fog and swirling all about them. Ryan closed his eye. Christy opened her eyes and stared in wonder at the chamber around her. Silk tapestries adorned the walls, rich rugs were on the floors, and the ivory chairs, benches, and divans were littered with satin cushions. The canopy over the bed in which she lay was hung with gauzy draperies, softly stirred by an intoxicatingly sweet breeze, scented like orange blossoms. Stretching, she turned over on her side, wondering why Ryan wasn't beside her. She needed Ryan beside her, above her. She bolted upright in the bed, pushing herself into a sitting position. A sudden alarm casting all other thoughts aside, evaporating the sensual and lascivious sensations that had nearly consumed her. She remembered Ryan sitting beside her in the gateway chamber as the jump mechanism triggered. She slid out of the bed and turned toward the great bronze double doors at the far end of the room. She saw no knobs or handles. She ran to it and smote the thick metal with her clenched hands.
Ryan! Help me! Ryan!
Even as she did so, the great bronze doors swung back on hidden hinges, revealing a heavy golden chain across the entrance. Then the chain dropped without a sound. Beyond the threshold was a long, dim vista of hall. Framed at the far end was a powerful man-shape, looming gigantic in the gloom. Christy couldn't make out any features. Then, two red flickering orbs appeared, right where a normal man's eyes should be. The shadow slipped away from the figure, or he stepped from them, she couldn't tell. A man stood in the center of the hall, towering well over 6 feet, nearly half a head taller than Ryan. His shoulders were incredibly broad, his arms long and bronzed, his hairless chest rippling with muscles. He was stark naked. A wave of sensations flooded through Christy. First, a rise of fiery desire, then a possessiveness, almost fiercely maternal, and the urge to protect and nurture. The man beckoned to her with his right hand, a simple gesture, but somehow very sensual. The crimson eyes blazed upon her with an unremitting, hypnotic intensity. Christy felt herself drifting forward, toward those corded arms spread wide in a welcoming embrace. Vaguely, she was aware of her diaphanous clothing dropping from her body, floating behind her. With great effort, she tried to stop herself, but she managed only to slow her gliding approach.
You can't have me. I belong to another.
You belong to me. I've waited an eternity for you. You will be the mother of a dynasty that will last 10,000 years.
Then she was in his arms, the sleek, muscled nakedness of his body pressing against her breasts. She stared into the red flame of lust in his eyes. His lips touched hers.
You won't have me. Ryan.
Ryan opened his eye, galvanized by the terror in Christie's voice, her words echoing within the walls of his skull. Bounding to his feet, he reached for the door to the gateway chamber. Jerking up the handle, he shouldered it open, realizing distantly that the heavy armor glass weighed no more than a thin layer of cloth. The door opened directly into a long, broad hall that ran away until it grew indistinct in the murky distance. He raced along the corridor, not allowing himself a moment to clear the confusion in his thoughts. The corridor walls were lined by flickering torches and metal sconces. The floor, walls, and ceiling were of stone, cut into huge square blocks. The walls on either side of him were covered with brightly colored friezes, portraying olive-skinned men and women. They wore filmy robes, fantastic headpieces, and many jeweled ornaments, and were depicted mostly in positions of lovemaking. The image flickered and changed whenever Ryan tried to focus his eye on them. As he ran past, it almost seemed that the women in the friezes bore Christie's face, or hair, or eyes. The women smiled as their bodies were fondled by various male partners, some of them with handsome, finely chiseled features and others that looked more like dogs or reptiles. Ryan kept running, feeling his heart thud painfully inside his chest. He dashed through a series of empty chambers, lit by a ghostly, elusive illumination. Some of the chambers showed as black as the mouth of hell, and he tried to avoid slowing down in these. The long corridor abruptly ended in utter, impenetrable blackness, like a sepia sea. Ryan couldn't stop running. Smoldering in the darkness before him, he saw a pair of crimson eyes, glowing like evil stars in an empty, sunless universe. He tried to stop, to slow down, to change direction. Instead, he hurtled forward, all control gone. The crimson radiance grew brighter, more vivid, and he saw a face. It was a man's face, undeniably human, yet with alien, hellishly glowing red eyes. Then the flesh seemed to melt away, revealing a mask of naked white bone. A grinning skull floated in the sepia sea, a skull of ivory in which sparks of livid red flame danced within the shadowed sockets. The death's head leered at him, and the jaws of the skull opened. Ryan plunged toward that gaping maw, determined not to give voice to his surge of terror. Mildred bent over the slack forms of Ryan and Christy, fingering the pulse beats at the base of their throats. JB moved closer, putting on his spectacles.
What's wrong with them?
I don't know. Seems like some sort of shock. Pulse rates are irregular.
The jump was unusually smooth for me. No nausea whatsoever.
They were close to the door. Maybe somebody opened it just when we jumped. Wouldn't be the first time.
Perhaps we should minister to them in more felicitous surroundings.
Jack stepped over Ryan and Christie's legs and opened the door to the hexagonal chamber.
I make a wreck.
JB unlimbered his Uzi and stood at the open door in case he was needed, but Jack returned in short order.
Ante room, control room, empty.
Dean, Mildred, and JB grabbed Ryan's limp body by the arms and legs and half carried, half dragged the man out of the chamber. Jack and Doc had an easier time with Christy. They carried their friends out of the small anteroom, past computer consoles and readout screens, and down a short hallway. Fluorescent light strips glowed feebly from the ceiling.
Look at the murals on the walls. Hieroglyphs, too.
What?
Ye gods. I mean that literally. Ptah, Anubis, Set, Osiris.
What you talking about, Doc?
Jack followed the older man's eye and head movements, but saw nothing but smooth, unadorned walls. Doc started to nod toward the wall on his right. Then his eyes narrowed, widened, and his mouth creaked open. He shook his head.
Perhaps the light is playing tricks on me.
The hallway opened up into a small room that held only a table and a few chairs. Mildred and JB laid Ryan on the floor, and Christy was gently placed on the tabletop.
Oh, you can't have me. I belong to another.
Immediately, Ryan's eyes snapped open, and he levered upright from the waist. He clawed at his holstered gun. Christy was on his blind side, and his face was a mask of agony and fear until he caught sight of her.
What the fuck happened to me?
You were out of it for a little while, Dad, that's all.
How's Christy?
Fine.
Waving aside JB's proffered hand, Ryan climbed unsteadily to his feet and bent over Christy. She, too, had returned to somewhat confused consciousness. Sitting up, she embraced Ryan.
Gaia, never had a jump nightmare like that before.
Me neither. We'll talk about it later. Find out first where we are. Anybody do a wreck?
Only to hear.
Nothing unusual?
Not unless you consider two of our friends being unable to wake up unusual.
And wall paintings being there one moment and gone the next.
All right. Let's do this by the book. Triple red.
The group formed a wedge, with Ryan and JB taking the point, the others fanning out behind. The wedge was the standard formation while exploring a strange redoubt. With the toe of a boot, Ryan eased open the door on the opposite end of the room. Beyond it was a small foyer and another door. It was a disc sheathed in gleaming metal, surrounded by three concentric collars of steel. Affixed on the wall beside it was a setcode keypad. Beneath the keypad was a plastic sign bearing red lettering. Biohazard beyond this point. Entry forbidden to personnel not wearing anti-contaminant clothing. Half a dozen one-piece coveralls hung from hooks on the wall. Hoods with transparent plexiglass faceplates were attached to them.
Fireblast.
As far as Ryan knew, biological warfare hadn't played a large role in the new cost, since the actual active conflict had lasted less than a day. He touched one of the coveralls with the built-in baffle silencer of the 6-hour.
Damn. Mildred, take a look at this.
Oh, God.
How bad could it be?
Might not be bad at all. Then again, all sorts of bacteria, rickettsia, viruses, and fungi spores could be floating around in there.
Still potent? Still communicable after all this time?
Could be. But you, John, Jack, Dean, and Christy were born in the Deathlands. More than likely, you've developed natural resistances to infectious agents that may be fatal to me and Doc.
Comforting notion.
Dark Knight, why couldn't this place be like most of the other redoubts?
Odds were we'd pop up into a medical installation sooner or later. Frankly, I'm surprised we hadn't before now, since we learned that bioengineering programs were going on prior to Skydark. And after.
Maybe we should try another jump.
I don't think that's necessary. Just because this place may have housed biological weapons, it doesn't mean any of them got loose.
I recall reading an account of the expedition who entered King Tut's tomb. Many of them died mysteriously, and though some believed an ancient pharaoh's curse was responsible, more enlightened minds speculated that 3,000-year-old microbes were the culprits.
Muzzle it, Doc. You don't have to try to scare us to death.
That's for sure.
Well, do we try our luck out there, or back in the gateway?
After a moment of considered silence, everyone decided, in monosyllables, to find out what lay beyond the steel portal. Ryan's hand poised over the keypad.
Should we hold our breaths?
Not unless you're trying to win a contest. If microorganisms are free in there, most likely they were designed to attack the human body through the skin.
Damn it, Millie, for the last time, what do you think the odds are of us contracting some kind of manufactured disease?
Slim to none. I'm basing that assessment on a lack of outbreaks of incurable illnesses in most of the vills we visited.
Ryan's hand suddenly darted to the keypad and swiftly punched in the entry code. The metal disc rolled to the left. No one moved. Peering into the murk beyond the portal, all Ryan could see was dim light gleaming from polished metal and glass.
Air is fresh enough. There is no scent of bacteria befouling the atmosphere.
There wouldn't be. Do you know what the Ebola virus smells like?
Ryan stepped over the raised lip of the entrance lock. His eye took in the heavy tables loaded with a complicated network of glass tubes, beakers, and retorts, consoles with glass-covered gauges, and computer terminals. The right-hand wall was completely covered by armaglass, running the entire 20-yard length of the room. On the far wall was a twin of the disc-shaped entrance portal. Ryan moved carefully into the room, the 6-hour ready, barrels sweeping back and forth in short half-arcs. Behind him, the others fanned out, weapons gripped in ready hands. He didn't pause to examine anything in the strange chamber. He sidled across it. Only when he reached the metal-colored disc did he stop and look around. His friends milled around him, eyes alert and watchful.
Huh. Wanna look around in here or wreck the rest of the redoubt?
Makes more sense to find out where we are.
Another keypad was on the wall, and Ryan thumbed in the open code, the thick slab of metal rolling obediently aside. Down a short hallway, with rooms on either side, he could see the massive vanadium steel sector. It was down.
Look safe.
They moved quietly down the passage. The doors to the rooms they passed were open, and quick glances showed chambers in which to sleep, to cook, to wash.
Smaller than most redoubts.
Usually, the underground installations were multi-leveled labyrinths of corridors, dormitories, and control rooms. This one was Spartan and miniaturized. Ryan paused at the sector, turned toward Dean, and gestured to the green lever on the steel frame.
You want the honor, son?
Sure, Dad.
Dean smiled and moved forward as Ryan knelt at the center of the door. The other shifted position, fingers tight on triggers, weapons trained on the rectangle of alloy.
Go.
Dean threw the lever up, and the door slid slowly upward. As the bottom edge cleared 5 or 6 inches above the floor, Dean shifted the lever to a midpoint position. The door stopped rising. Ryan went flat on the floor and squinted out between the vanadium and the concrete. He saw nothing but darkness, and a cool breeze played over his face. Wind-driven grains of sand danced over the threshold.
Door leads to the outside. You're right, Jack. Place is a lot smaller than usual. Up another 6 inches, son.
This time, Ryan saw sand, silvered by moonlight. The air was fresh, clean, and very dry. In the distance, he saw nothing but a sandy sea of desolation.
Now all the way up, Dean.
The massive door ascended, then stopped. A swirl of air breezed into the corridor, bringing a scattering of sand. A reef of clouds crossed the face of the quarter moon, obscuring the view of their surroundings. Not that there was much to see. No vegetation grew within their range of vision, not even the hardy strain of flower that Christie had named the Deathlands Daisy.
Looks like the Sahara.
Or the Gobi.
Both places were possibilities. The scientists of the totality concept had evidently been determined to link every continent with gateway units. As for America, it seemed that the entire country was honeycombed with the hidden installations.
Too overcast to make an accurate sextant reading. Maybe we should wait until dawn.
I, for one, do not fancy a sleepover in an environment that may be percolating with every germ, virus, and plague known to man, or unknown to man.
We're infected already. That is, if we're fated to be infected. Besides, our provisions are running low, and this looks to be the only grocery store for miles around.
Ryan gestured to Dean. The lad moved the lever, and the huge door rumbled down.
Let's see what we've got here.
As it turned out, there wasn't much. What they had already seen of the installation was basically all there was to it. In a kitchen, Jack found a few sealed ration packs in a cabinet. The freeze-dried food was tasteless, but it was nutritious. Their biggest worry was water. But when they tried the faucets, the liquid that flowed out smelled and tasted fresh and untainted. Even the hot water taps worked, so the heating system was still functional. Though smaller by far than almost every other redoubt they had visited, the place appeared to be in better condition.
Pretty clean in here.
What did you expect from doctors?
It's not just that. It almost looks like somebody has been taking care of this place. Fairly recently, too.
A total of 18 beds were divided between the 3 bunk rooms. The bathroom had 5 toilet stalls and 3 urinals. Though 3 shower heads projected from the tiled wall inside an enclosure, there was a 6.5-foot-tall, bullet-shaped cylinder in one corner. Though everyone else was mystified by its purpose and function, Ryan was familiar with it.
I saw one like it in the anthill. The Freezies called it a metasterile unit.
What's it for?
A bug chaser. A decontamination chamber, in case any of the personnel here were directly exposed to something toxic or infectious.
Yeah. The Freezies stuck me in one. Guess they thought I had cooties.
They searched all the rooms. One thing they expected to find, but didn't, were the skeletonized remains of the installation's personnel.
The folks here must have jumped out a long time ago. Doubt they went overland.
In an office suite, they found 6 partition-enclosed desks, all of them equipped with computer terminals. 2 gray steel file cabinets stood in a corner. Tacked on the wall, faded and yellowed with age, was a sign.
Geneticists do everyone better. Ha! Inside humor.
What are you looking for?
The standard slogan of pre-dark offices. A sign that says, you don't have to be crazy to work here, but it sure helps.
Ryan tugged on a drawer handle of one of the file cabinets. It slid open with surprising ease, though it was jammed with paper and notebooks. He pulled out one at random.
Over Project Excalibur. Mission Invictus.
Invictus. Latin for invincible.
Opening the notebook, Ryan saw only columns of closely set type and mathematical formulas. Illegible handwritten notations were scrawled all around the columns. As he thumbed through the notebook, Ryan found a double page spread containing the graphic of a twisting, ladder-like helix.
DNA molecules. That cinches it. This was definitely some kind of genetics lab.
Ryan slapped the notebook shut. He forced it back into the drawer and slammed it closed.
Was there nothing too foul for your pre-duck wet guts to fuck around with?
Unfortunately, no.
They returned to the kitchen and made a quick meal out of the contents of one of the sealed packages. It was a sort of gruely oatmeal soup, sweetened with brown sugar.
I wish I knew if this was breakfast or dinner.
What difference does it make, John Barrymore? Breakfast, brunch, or lunch, these viands would still be unsatisfactory, even to the most undiscriminating of palates.
Shit. Crap don't know if it wants to be ate or drunk.
I like it.
I want to check out the laboratory facility.
No, there's no telling what kind of germs are in there, Millie.
And there's no telling what kind of medical stores are in there. How many times have we, and others, suffered because of a lack of proper medicines? I won't pass up this chance.
Enough. Let's get some rest. We'll talk about it in the morning.
Whenever that be. I take the first watch.
I don't think that's necessary. This place is secure.
Mildred remained seated as the others rose and filed from the room. JB paused in the doorway.
Coming to bed, Millie?
I caught a nap on the boat, remember? I'll stay up for a while. Don't worry. I won't go into the lab area. I do want to check over the files in the office, though.
Nodding brusquely, JB went out into the hall. Mildred sat for a few moments, then walked out into the corridor. Inside the office suite, she devoted 20 minutes to methodically riffling through the contents of the file cabinets. Most of the paperwork meant very little. Requisition forms, duty rosters, personnel records. Still, a vague picture of the purpose of the redoubt emerged. One name figured prominently in memo headings and signatures, a Dr. Connaught O'Brien. Mildred frowned, turning the name over in her mind. A faint bell of recognition chimed in the recesses of her memory. In one drawer, she found a square leather packet. It was imprinted with a symbol that was familiar, but slightly different from what she had seen before. It was a red triangle with three vertical lines enclosed within it. She and her friends had encountered a similar symbol a few months before, when they jumped into a subterranean installation in Dulce, New Mexico. There, however, the lines had been horizontal. These resembled stylized round-topped daggers. The packet's flap was sealed with a tiny combination lock. Rather than waste time in a trial-and-error process to find the proper sequence, she took a penknife from a pocket and sawed through the leather. She tugged out a sheaf of papers bound in booklet form and a multimedia compact disc in a slip sleeve. The first page of the papers bore the heading, Over Project Excalibur, Mission Invictus, Alpha Subject Circumscription, Final Report Prepared by Dr. C. O'Brien. Most of the pages of the booklet were full of technical terms, schematics, and diagrams. The last half held color video scanned images. The photographs were of two dark-haired babies about 3 months old. The boy looked unusually somber. The girl, on the other hand, grinned gummily and waved pudgy hands. Mildred wanted to smile, but she couldn't quite bring it off. The children were certainly beautiful, but their big eyes possessed no pupils, irises, or whites. Their eyes were a solid blood red. She flipped through the photo section, noting that after a certain point there were no more pictures of the little girl. There were, however, many of the boy child, obviously encompassing a number of years. It was as if the photographer, whoever he or she had been, had devoted inestimable hours to capturing every month of the youth's life on film. When the pictures depicted the boy in what appeared to be his teenage years, their quality subtly changed. Mildred found a series of head and shoulder shots. The youth's smooth forehead was unusually high, his nose aquiline. His mouth was long, with a full underlip. His raven's wing black hair was straight and cut short, combed back from a pronounced widow's peak. His skin was deeply tanned. Only the crimson hue of his eyes marred the classical perfection of his face. Several photos showed the boy striking poses, wearing only white briefs. He stood with his hands on his hips, or his arms raised to show off bulging biceps and swelling pectorals. The intent seemed almost pornographic. When Mildred saw the last photograph, she amended that. It was pornographic. The boy looked to be about 16 years old. He leaned against a blank wall, hands clasped casually behind his back, one leg slightly bent at the knee. He held his head tilted at an arrogant angle, and a slight superior smile creased his lips. He was in a high state of sexual arousal, and his erection seemed as arrogant as the position of his head. She slapped the booklet shut, wondering what possible scientific purpose the last few photographs had served and who had taken them, or worse, who had authorized them. Picking up the CD, Mildred went from one comp console to the other, flipping their power switches. She tried three before a monitor screen lit up and flashed a flickering life. Sitting down before it, she inserted the disc into the drive port, and the red triangle symbol appeared. Beneath it, a date appeared, 1-18-08. Absently, she noted the date as being almost exactly 7 years to the day after the first mushroom cloud had swallowed Washington, D.C.
Mission Invictus update. Final report. Authorized personnel only. MJ Ultra clearance required.
The symbol vanished from the screen, replaced an instant later by the head and shoulders of a woman. Her dark red hair was tied back, and her leaf-green eyes were covered by a pair of steel-rimmed spectacles. Despite her lack of cosmetics and the impersonal clinical expression on her face, she was very pretty. She appeared to be in her late 30s or early 40s. Behind the woman, Mildred could just make out black-topped lab tables laden with glassware. Mildred recognized her. Dr. Connaught O'Brien had enjoyed her 15 minutes of fame in the late 1990s. A biologist and an outspoken proponent of eugenics and selective breeding, she had made the lecture and talk show circuit for a few months before vanishing from the public eye. The woman's basic thesis was that technology had changed and improved every aspect of human society, yet the human race itself was trapped in an evolutionary corral. O'Brien had maintained that human development had to catch up to technical advances. The media had pinned the catch-all label technogenics as a buzzword to categorize her theories. It was one she had strenuously objected to, but the appellation stuck. As Mildred recalled, during the storm of negative publicity, O'Brien had been dismissed from her post at Johns Hopkins University amid accusations that she was Joseph Mengele in drag. Obviously, when she had vanished, it was to work for Over Project Excalibur.
The third revolution of human progress is well underway. It affects us so deeply that some people in high places would rather maintain an uneasy silence than see it through to its fruition. Mission Invictus is the only true success in Over Project Excalibur. And yet that success is now threatened by the same powers that insisted upon its implementation in the first place. You who are seeing this and hearing my words know to whom I am referring. You say I have gone too far in developing a human organism that will survive in the post-Holocaust world. This is not a new accusation. I will not bore you with a recitation of my own personal injuries suffered by the small-minded attitude of the mainstream scientific community in the course of my work as a geneticist. I agreed to work for Over Project Excalibur to be free of those constraints, of those misunderstandings. My assignment was to create a superior life form that exhibited the necessary adaptive traits for survival in the new world, including reproduction. Given the immutable fact that time did not permit breeding a superior race in terms of normal gestation periods and maturity cycles, I was forced to a single conclusion. Mutation. It wasn't just for money or to expand the fields of knowledge that I embarked on the course I followed. Certainly money has no meaning now. It is a matter of conscience. You yourselves dictated that Mission Invictus was the only rational means to restore order and harmony to the world. The Unisex program and the Genesis Project were deemed failures. Mission Invictus is not, however you may argue it. I will not explain how my biochemically synthesized gene mutations were utilized in the creation of the Alpha and Epsilon subjects. The fact that I succeeded where those others failed should provide the smallest hint of the magnitude of this miracle. The loss of Epsilon does not invalidate the miracle. No one regrets the accident more than I, but I am able to maintain my perspective while all about me, everyone has lost theirs. Now, upon the dawn of a new age of human evolution, the same old primitive fear sets in again. The fear of the inferior man facing the superior man.